Hello everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Rob.
Hello.
And Mick.
Hello.
And it's another one of our monthly comics blowout specials.
Yes,
because some months there are just too many comics.
Exactly. Speaking of, something I keep meaning to mention on the show and forgetting is a big thanks to Turnaround Books, who are the ones that send us all these review copies.
Yes. Yes, Turnaround Publishers are really good to us. Sometimes a bit too good.
Hence the monthly blowouts.
Exactly.
Oh God, I have so many things to read still.
So many comics. So little time.
And has there ever been a comic book podcast or a comic book show where they just complain they have far too many?
Yeah, I feel like we are definitely not gaining the sympathies of the listeners, are we?
Exactly. Yeah, they must be sat at home, their poor hearts bleeding for us.
Yes, poor us, given too many free comics to read.
Yeah.
So who wants to kick things off?
I was about to say...
Is a question we should have asked before we started recording.
Shall I go first?
Yeah, go on then.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to kick things off with Halo.
Now, Halo!
Yeah, I have a couple of Halo things. They're both separate stories in their entirety, but I'm going to do them both together since they are both Halo. The first one is the second volume of the Halo Omnibus. Now, I did the Halo Omnibus, the first volume, not too long ago. I can't remember exactly which episode. But anyway, this is continuing on the story of basically what happens when everything messes up in Halo and people are running and screaming and aliens are joining forces with humans and there's all sorts of clandestine politics and everything like that. You know when sci-fi gets really political? It's kind of that. It's kind of that when sci-fi gets really political. So anyway, in this, you have the Spartan commander, or the new Spartan commander from the Neo-Spartans, I suppose that you call them, because they're not the Master Chief Spartans. These ones are the new breed of Spartans who were all fully trained military adults before they became Spartans, rather than kids taken off the streets and then injected with loads of drugs and then brainwashed and forced into military training.
These aren't the Captain America-styled Spartans.
No, these are kind of a cross between the Captain America-style Spartans and the, I suppose you'd call them more humanitarian Spartans. They're still kind of, genetically engineered killers, but...
Which are the ones you can snipe me from all the way to the other side of Blood Gulch? Because those are the ones I hate.
Well, the Spartans are Spartans, whether they're version 1 or version 2 or version whatever they are now. Anyway... Commander Sarah Palmer she's got a bit of a peeve after the last omnibus because Dr. Catherine Halsey, who was the creator of the Spartans in the first place, has basically turned traitor according to the UNSC and according to everybody because she's joined forces with the Covenant and they're off looking for... they met one of the early alien creatures, one of the founders, the creators of the Halo rings and stuff like that, called the Librarian, which really isn't the coolest name that you could pick for a being of supreme intelligence and immense power.
No, usually you go with a name like Mick.
Well, it's kind of Marvel level of naming these supreme beings, because you've got the Collector, you've got the Watchers... You see what I mean? So calling someone the Librarian. So anyway, Catherine Halsey met the Librarian and was given a couple of keys that gave her access to a particular artifact that would link up to all of the other artifacts left by the progenitors. Calling them progenitors because I can't remember what they actually call them in Halo, because really, it's Halo and there's a lot of it. And if you try and remember the names of everything...
The Forerunners,
yeah. Like Progenitors, Forerunners, they basically mean the same thing.
I've played a Halo game.
I played a Halo game back when it first appeared on the Xbox. and then played Halo 2 and then forgot Halo existed until I started reading the comics. Now, the comics are suitably action-packed. This one is very action-packed, in fact. There's a lot of action going on. There's kind of a Just Desserts and Pride leading to a fall. All of those good things that you see in stories. But there's also little bits, little asides that tell the stories of some of the Spartans, you know, give a little background to some of the other Spartan characters, which is nice to see. But in the end, this is still just a tale of, look, humans, they want to expand the universe, but they have no idea how to, and so they go around picking fights with everybody and abusing technology that they really shouldn't have access to. Go, humans!
You've got to finish the fight. That's a Halo thing.
Yeah, exactly. I've got to say, it's an interesting story, this one. It is an interesting story, but it's also a bit of a slog. I mean, it's written by Duffy Boudreau with art by Sergio Arrieno and Douglas Franchin, inks by Juan Castros, Denise Freitas, Rob Lean, colours by Michael Attia, and letters by Michael Heisler. And it's very well drawn. It is actually surprisingly well written. It seems like this one is on much more firmer ground than the first volume, where it jumped around a little bit. There's more of a linearity to the story. The Covenant are suitably ugly and non-human, and the humans are suitably ugly on the inside and human. And, you know, the Forerunners, they're suitably enigmatic. There are a couple of issues with regards to just who's in the right and who's in the wrong, which really you don't know, because this is one of those stories where it basically tries to say everybody's in the wrong because everybody is just trying to live the best life they can. So good, you know? But Halo, Omnibus, Volume 2, it's really for the Halo fans. It really is for the Halo fans. If you are a diehard Halo fan, definitely get that, because that will keep you entertained for a while and give you, I wouldn't say much needed backstory relating to the games, but it'll give you story relating to the games. On the other hand, and exactly like when I covered the Omnibus, I also have a standalone issue of Halo called Lone Wolf. This one's written by Ann Toole, with art by Kieran McKeown, inks by J.L. Straw, colours by Dan Jackson, and letters by Simon Borland. And this one is a very different animal altogether, because this one is much smaller, much shorter, much more compact, and much more concise in terms of its story. And this is about a Spartan called Linda 058, who is a sniper, one of those snipers that you're talking about.
It's her or him, but it's that one. That's the one who keeps popping me in the head.
Yeah.
We're going to round up the boys, we're going to get in the Warthog, and we're going to accidentally flip the whole thing over the first tiny stone we find.
Yes. So, she is superior in infiltration and marksmanship, and she's called upon to end the threat posed by a wanted scientist on a distant planet. With only an AI on her side called Athos, who dresses like a musketeer for some reason, Linda must fight through both the dregs of the Covenant and the hostility of a lost human settlement to stop the rogue scientist in his tracks. And this one, because it's a much shorter story, because it's more concise, it's actually more interesting, because they manage to pack a lot in there, but they also leave you with a couple of questions that make you want to read more. The artwork is pretty good throughout. The scientist's motives you never really get into, because I think that would basically be more information than you require. It's very simple in this. She's got a mission to hunt down the scientist. He's basically put himself in a position where he's got loads of followers who he's not told the truth to. And so she's now in a quandary. Does she kill him and try and evacuate everybody after the fact, or does she try and evacuate everybody, including him, and then kill him afterwards? How does she work out this mission? Because ultimately, the mission has to succeed because she's a Spartan. And so that's basically the interesting side of this particular story. There's some interesting discussions between Linda and the AI Athos, because he wants the mission to continue. and he questions her judgment and questions her loyalty even on occasion, because he's just an AI and she is basically a Spartan. Something close to human, but not quite. And I have to say, I like this one so much more than The Omnibus. The Omnibus is basically for diehard fans of Halo. It goes into a lot of the backstory, goes into a lot of technical details about Halo and about the Forerunners, about the Covenant, about the Flood, about all sorts of things. Whereas this one is more a standalone story about a single Spartan off on a mission, and it's much more accessible to somebody who isn't really a Halo fan. So if you're interested in Halo, or if you have a passing interest in learning more about Halo, I'd recommend Halo Lone Wolf and some of the other Halo standalone graphic novels, because they are more accessible. When it comes to the collected works, like the Omnibus stuff, it's much harder going. You definitely need more information, more history about Halo. That's only available through playing the games before you can really settle down and read them. With these standalone ones, though, you can just pick up and enjoy. So, yeah, that's Halo.
Plus, I imagine the Omnibus is that's just a lot of comics.
It is a lot of comics, but when it dives into it, it expects you to know something about the history of Halo, and it kind of expects you to have played some of the games as well. It's a bit like the Dragon
Age
comics.
It's okay, because we've already summarized the entire history of Halo, which is Forerunners or Progenitors or whatever. Now you've got Spartans, finish the fight. Now you've got new Spartans. Sometimes AIs wear clothes. Sometimes they choose to be naked.
Yes.
That's Halo.
Well, that saved me playing through 5 games. Oh, no, it's 6 now, isn't it?
It's exactly. More than
You're
6.
You're very welcome, Mick.
It's more than 6, Mick, isn't it?
Well, only if you count ODST and Halo Wars 1 and 2. But they're different types of games set in the universe.
Yeah, but what about Halo Reach?
That's another different type of game.
What about ODST?
Yeah, that one seems like a bit of a stretch, Rob.
What about ODST?
I said ODST.
Did you?
I said Halo Reach sounds like a bit of a stretch.
We know. We ignored you on purpose.
Yeah. If only we could do the same with Rob as effectively.
It's not how the show works and you know it. Now, Mick, you talk about comics while I sulk.
Okay. Right. Well, I've got, first up, a surprise one for me, actually, because it's Bucky Barnes in what can only be described as Son of Batman.
It is, isn't it? It is.
Yeah, yeah.
When you said that, I was thinking, actually, that's absolutely right.
I mean, it doesn't help that on the cover, the young lad that the Winter Soldier sort of decides to try and find a new life for actually looks a lot like Robin.
Yes, he does.
So, yeah, this is Winter Soldier Second Chances, which is by...
Actually, are they even doing, like, the Batman and Robin-style leap on the cover?
Yep.
Yeah, they are.
Oh, dear.
So it's by Kyle Higgins and Rod Reis, lettering by VC's Clayton Cowles, because apparently Marvel don't have any letterers of their own anymore. They bring in people from VC, whoever they are. And so I thought this was going to be quite interesting. It means I don't have to read about the dullard that is Captain America. We have his slightly more interesting sidekick, Bucky Barnes. And then as I started reading it, what started off as a nice little storyline about Bucky finding new paths. It's like a sort of Avengers-led witness protection scheme for ex-members of Hydra.
Yeah.
Who've realised that Hydra aren't the cool kids that they thought they were when they joined the gang.
Well,
wait a sec. The guys dressed in green who worship dragon monsters are the bad guys.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Literally that Mitchell and Webb sketch.
It really is. The thing is, Bucky didn't really decide to hang out with the cool kids, did he?
This is him now. He works alongside Sharon Carter in Indiana, and he operates this witness protection scheme.
I've just realised what he is. You know those former gang members who basically now work as social outreach workers to try and stop kids getting into gangs?
Yeah, but what Bucky does is he makes life difficult for himself because he lets them join the gangs first. And then they're part of the gang, and then they decide that the gang's doing bad things, and then they ring him on a special number, and he checks out their story, and they cry a lot, and he sets them up in a new life. And, I mean, this is... this is an actual interaction between him and one of the people who's living this new life but has put it in jeopardy by ringing one of his former contacts, right? Yeah. You were helping Hydra torture people, Terry. I know. You told me you couldn't live with yourself anymore, that you would do anything to be done with them and have a real chance at a life of your own. Remember? This is where he's trying to explain why it is that Terry has gone from torturing people for Hydra to bagging groceries for a living. And this is clearly not a career choice that Terry is happy with, because he spends like the entire two or three pages with tears fixed to his face.
Not falling, just fixed, like they're glued on.
They don't move in like five frames. they're like painted on tears. Anyway, that's sort of preamble introducing us, because Terry's been hunted down because he's given his position away, and someone's found him in this new life of grocery bagging that Bucky has drawn him into, and he's been hunted down by a Hydra agent called RJ, who is basically, he's Damian from Son of Batman. He's Damian Wayne. He's a guy with attitude, a young lad who's been conditioned, not in the same way, but in a similar way to how Bucky had been conditioned before. And so, obviously, Bucky applies his own new sort of rules to trying to redeem RJ, and starts taking him on missions. And we meet some Hydra agents that are still trying to convince RJ that he's... his future is with them, and then the spot turns up.
You know when you say he basically takes him on missions and stuff like that? Doesn't someone get beaten up? Was it Bucky gets beaten up by RJ, or RJ gets beaten up by Bucky? I can't remember.
There's so many fights in this comic, it's easy to lose count. They have a fight against the Spot, or Dalmatian Man, as I like to call him. But yeah, they have a few little spats where they end up kicking the juices out of each other.
This is after the Spot gets killed by his arch nemesis Cruella de Vil.
Yeah. that's a mashup that could happen now that Disney and Marvel are one, isn't it?
Oh my god, it could, couldn't it? Run, Spot!
See Spot, run. Run, Spot, run.
Anyway, then on to the scene while Bucky's trying to rescue RJ from his life of Hydra servitude. Along comes RJ's dad, who spins a yarn about having set up a new life for himself, and RJ wants Bucky to help his dad, and blah, 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 de blah, de blah, de blah. And then the rest of the story is just quite predictable and terrible, and it's all very sad, but in that way that you expect it to really be sad. And RJ has father figures that he doesn't realise are father figures, and suddenly he realises that Bucky was the father figure he needed all along, and Bucky realises that he can rescue RJ, but not in the way that he thinks he needs to rescue. And it all looks like... And the art makes everybody look like a cheap knockoff of Nightwing, so...
Do you know what it is? I read this as well, and it struck me that basically it was a Sunset Beach plot with superheroes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read this as third, and I've actually got a theory on what happened in this series, which is, so as you said, they fight Spot, who has the ability to create special portals. And I think what must have happened is during that fight, he accidentally opened a portal into the soap opera dimension.
Yes. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's also full of guest stars.
Who never stick around to help out properly.
Yeah. I mean, on the very first page, there's a couple of cops. Well, I think they're fake cops, aren't they, that are staging a heist. And the bald guy in the front is definitely Bruce Willis. RJ's dad appears to be Brent Spiner from Star Trek Next Gen.
Well, that's all this Marvel movie money that can get these celebrity guest stars now. But I joke, but I remember seeing this one advert for, I think it was the Black Widow series, where they had, I can't remember what it was, but it was like one of the TV newscasters was in one of the issues. And they made a big song and dance of like, guest starring in this week's issue with John Anderson Cooper, that's his name. No, you've got the artist to draw him. That's yeah. Not the same thing at all.
Also, RJ's Hydra handler appears to be David Bowie, circa 1983.
Yes, he is, actually.
I'm so really disappointed that that guy doesn't at some point call this whole thing a god-awful small affair.
I have a question. Bucky's running a witness protection program for former Hydra members.
Yeah.
Is that all former Hydra members, or is it just the important ones?
No, I think it's the unimportant ones. I think that's the point.
Yeah, well, it's very specifically like the repentant ones.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean,
he's not going to help like the Red Skull go into hiding.
No, I'm not on about him. I'm not on about the Red Skull. I'm on about Bob the Hydra janitor, who didn't really do anything but cut the floors sparkly clean. Does he need to go into witness protection, for example?
Only if he realises that he was keeping the flaws of a despicable and evil organisation sparkly clean.
Yeah, but
if he realises that, then he can have a new life.
But what if Bob couldn't find a
slightly different job?
Yeah, but what if Bob couldn't find another job? What if that was the only job he could get because he got into a relationship that had a kid while he was still in school, and so he had to go out. He got kicked out of the house. Then the typical kind of...
yeah, but he doesn't have to find himself another job, does he? Because Bucky finds the job as well.
Yeah, that's...
It's a sort of witness protection stroke talent management role that he's...
Oh, my God. I should join Hydra.
No, I think you'll find, given the Job Centre logo is green, you already have...
Yes, Bucky, save me and set me up with a cushy job and maybe give me some kind of living allowance and a house.
I think if you like a redemption story and you haven't seen Son of Batman, this is probably a reasonable comic for you. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. It's just a story that we've seen a lot of times in various other media.
True. I don't know, because I felt even without that, I felt that this series was just way too melodramatic.
Yeah.
But then again, after the Winter Soldier, you know, where he was having to fight crossbones across various planets and the cosmos, and it got really trippy and weird, maybe this one is a lot more what they think is down to earth, but is very melodramatic and soap opera-y.
Boy, that other Winter Soldier series, that's...
Yeah, exactly.
This what an acid flashback is.
Yes. And now you know.
I'm also confused by the marketing material that appears in this edition. So on the front inner cover, there's Captain America Winter Soldier Ultimate Collection, right? But in the inside back cover, there's Winter Soldier The Complete Collection. I've got a feeling one of them's lying to me.
Probably. I mean, the Halo.
Yeah, I think you have to like ask each one of them a question, and if you get it right, the door opens and you can continue on the quest.
All right. Well, seeing as one of them, the quest involves Captain America, probably won't bother. So yeah, so that was Bucky Barnes believes in second chances.
Anyway, Andrew.
Yep. I have been reading from Marvel Comics, Conan the Barbarian, The Life and Death of Conan, Book 1. And yes, I said Life and Death of Life and Times, because that's what I've been calling it in my head all week.
What, The Life and Times of Conan? So,
So this is written by Jason Aaron with art by Mahmoud Azra for most of the issues and Gerardo Zaffino for issue 4 with colours by Matthew Wilson and letters by VC's Travis Lanham. So this is the story of everyone's favourite. Well, I'll let the book itself tell you. Hither came Conan the Cimmerian, black-haired, sullen-eyed, sword in hand. A thief, a reaver, a slayer, with gigantic melancholies and gigantic mirth, to tread the jeweled thrones of the earth under his sandaled feet. And I like that they've done that introduction over like a montage of panels from the original Conan comic series.
Awesome.
Which was a very nice touch.
I've got a question. Is it Cimmerian or Cimmerian? I could never figure that one out.
I don't know. I just don't. My natural inclination is to say Cimmerian. Because I feel like that's how it works in English. But it could be either, because we have a garbage language that doesn't make any sense at all. So yeah, if you know the correct pronunciation, write in and I'll be happy to ignore it.
Unless, of course, you're Conan, in which case he'll go with whatever you say.
Yeah, I don't think Conan's going to write in. If anything, he's just going to walk, like, burst in through the door and slam a knife down into my desk.
That's true.
And then go, it's Cimmerian, because you don't call me Sonan, do you?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. So, this starts, as all the best Conan stories do, with him violently dismembering a bunch of people. Because this is Conan in what I think is like his early 20s, fighting in like a gladiatorial pit. He kills a dude. There's a good bit where like the islander's spear was older than he was, hewn from a hellnail tree, found in the darkest, most impenetrable jungles of the Isle of Skellos. Conan had stolen his rusty sword the night before, losing his previous one in a drunken stupor. Which I like. I just like that as a little way of setting up these different combatants. Yes, it's cool for like Conan sort of immediately break. He loses it. So he ends up just like headbutting the spear in half, using the jagged, like broken ends to stab the islander and slicing his head off. So that goes well. That's Conan, you know, ticking one of his three main boxes. We later see him take off number 2, having a big old glass of wine, when a mysterious lady comes over to him for naughty fun times.
Is that Conan ticking off box number 3 then?
It very much is. Ticking that box, good. Or is he? Dun dun dun. Because turns out his sexy lady friend is actually an evil old hag.
And do you know the sad thing? That's the story of Conan's life, isn't it?
Pretty much. So yeah, she drugs Conan, takes him to a temple, and reveals that she needs the blood of a warrior to awaken the ancient god Razazel. But Conan's having none of that, so he smacks her in the face with a big iron ball. And
you see, I think this is why Conan never gets a second date.
It is. He certainly just does not know how to treat his ladies right.
He doesn't.
Like, silly Conan. He's supposed to not hit them in the neck with an axe.
He tends to put them off.
Does indeed. Although it turns out this one isn't too put off by it, because we then cut to decades later. Where Conan is now king of his own kingdom, and he is attacked again. This time, by the kind of reanimated corpse of the witch and her two children.
Oh, well, she's clearly quite keen on him.
Exactly. Because, as the book says, this is the story of how Conan lived and how he died. Got to admit, for the first issue, I wasn't entirely sold on the book. I think it suffers a bit from the John Carter problem, where it's a very typical Conan story. But that's the kind of tale that, like, loads of other fantasy things have taken inspiration from.
Yeah.
So now it feels a little bit cookie cutter.
Yeah.
And I think especially adding to that is it's Jason Aaron writing, and he's just, well, he's just winding up his big Thor thing. Well, a big part of that is having, like, the adventures of Thor in the present day, and also the adventures of, like, old King Thor in the future. So it's a very similar kind of setup. But I think I got more into the series as it went on, because each issue, kind of, it's a little bit more of this future storyline where Conan's kind of getting dragged back to the temple to maybe be sacrificed. But then it's an entire, like, self-contained adventure in the past. And so you get kind of a wealth of different stories. So, like, issue two is Conan ends up first hunting and then teaming up with the Picts to hunt, like, giant snake monsters in the jungle. And there's a fun bit about him, you know, realizing he's more at home living with these quote-unquote savages than he is in civilization. Then we've got issue three. Issue three is a fun one. It's basically Conan gets captured trying to rob a city on the outskirts of Numedia and ends up kind of getting hung, well, sorry, getting hanged on a tree. And he just escapes by, like, flexing his muscles so hard the tree cracks.
Sorry, what? He flexes so hard the tree cracks.
Because no tree can stand up to the mighty neck muscles of Conan the Barbarian. Then I think issues four and five are definitely my two favourite ones, because four takes place kind of in the earlier years of, like, Conan's rule of his kingdom. And basically the idea is he comes down with, like, warrior sickness, where he starts getting, like, as he's suffering from withdrawal from just not having battles anymore. So he ends up basically becoming, like, a Hyborian superhero. So he just tying a bandana around his face and, like, sneaking out at night to get into fights. Like, there's a fun bit where the narration is, the doctors couldn't explain why Conan's symptoms suddenly began manifesting as physical injuries. And you just see Conan just, like, shoving the door shut against the doctors while he desperately, like, ties bandages around a new stab wound. It's also great because he has a pet lion. A pet lion who he befriends by just punching in the nose.
That is actually the preferred method of befriending a lion.
It is. Go try it for yourselves. It's a four-panel recommended tip. Actually, no, please don't. We can't spare the listeners.
But it is a nice segue into our new podcast, Don't Try This at Home.
I mean, I feel like this podcast already is basically just a list of bad ideas. Speaking of, five is definitely my favourite, because it's Conan kind of doing a bit of, like, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, where he's stuck on an abandoned ship, and we see that, like, basically he tried to steal some kind of horrifying ancient artifact, but then they got raided by pirates, and when he killed one of the pirates, some blood got on the artifact, and giant, horrible tentacle monsters came outside slaughtering people.
I'm detecting a theme in your likes and dislikes.
Yeah, I have a type. But it's great, because there's a bit where, like, initially he tries to just dump all the dead bodies into the ocean, and the sharks eat them. But then the sharks get infected and, like, grow tentacles and crawl back onto the ship. So he ends up just stuck on, like, this rotting ship full of dead bodies. It's super dark and really rad. And then the last one is just him having some, I don't know, I'm going to say fun desert adventures. It's basically him telling a bunch of generals, hey, you should be careful, this is probably going to be a trap. And then they yell, shut up, you dumb savage. And then it turns out it's a trap and they all die. And then Conan gets made, like, chief general of the army. And then there's a bit of text about how years later Conan would just, like, turn against him because he's Conan. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. Just, you know, good, meaty, incredibly dark fantasy. I think, and again, like I said earlier, I think having each issue be a completely separate story really helps to kind of distinguish it a bit and make it and stop it feeling too cookie cutter. And the art's really good as well. Because I wasn't sure at first, because Mahmoud Azra, from what I've seen, he's got quite a cartoony style.
Yeah.
But I think, especially Matt Wilson's colours, they do a good job of making, kind of grounding it a little bit. So it feels, you know, kind of dustier and grimier and just, you know, full of all those good, horrible fluids that I like. Also, I love that the image on the back of is Conan sitting on a massive pile of bodies covered in blood. But don't worry, it's mostly not his.
And the bits that are his, it's just a flesh wound.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, yeah, that's me done. Back to you, Rob.
Yes, okay, so...
Actually, no special segue, because I've just seen a message that Mick has sent me.
Oh?
Mick, you've watched Pennyworth.
I did.
The prequel to the prequel to Batman.
I did.
Is it everything I could hope for?
I don't know. Is everything that you're hoping for a London-based, Batman-adjacent, modern-style Avengers thing? And by Avengers, I mean 1960s cult classic, not Marvel.
No.
With Paloma Faith punching people in the face.
Paloma Faith?
Paloma Faith punching people in the... I'm back on board. I briefly wouldn't, and I am.
Not only does Paloma Faith punch people in the face, but Paloma Faith punches people in the face with a northern accent.
I'm so watching this. I am so watching this.
I watched it last night, and it's funny because I've been recently sort of revisiting the Avengers and the new Avengers, courtesy of some of the more cheap end of Freeview channels. And I've been thinking, you know, would anybody have the guts to do a reboot or a continuation of a show like that now? And then I watched Pennyworth, and it turns out that yes, they would. I think it benefits from the fact that, of course, we don't have any familiarity with the characters. So, like, in Gotham, it was very much a sort of 50-50 whether people are going to like this interpretation of the Joker or this interpretation of the Penguin and the Riddler and the other characters.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to do any of the weird dancing about with stuff like, ooh, this is the Joker, but maybe he's not, but maybe he isn't, but actually it's his brother, but no, it isn't. It's his other brother.
Yeah, I think it's sort of set free, and it's more successful. I personally didn't mind Gotham. It lost its way a few occasions and sometimes got a little bit Moffat-style complicated in its plotting. But Pennyworth, from what I've seen of episode one, is just nicely surreal. And it's almost in a sort of heightened version of London. And it's difficult to determine when it is. Because one of the things about Gotham is it kind of looks like now, but in buildings that are really old. Whereas this looks like it's London kind of in the 60s, but kind of in the 40s, but kind of not sure what period.
Ah, cool, because I don't really like that aesthetic in Batman where it's like, it's the modern day, but also maybe the 1940s.
Yeah, I didn't switch it off.
And ooh, what higher praise is there?
Indeed. Awesome. Oh yeah, I'll probably give it another couple of episodes at least.
Okay.
Jason Fleming's in it as a raving maniac.
Oh, I like Jason Fleming. He's a weird face.
Yeah, you see?
But like a good weird face, like it's really craggy.
It's sounding better every moment.
It is. Except now we should probably go back to comics.
Right.
I should point out you took us on that segue.
Yes.
I did. Anyway. But I got excited.
Anyway, calm it, lad, calm it. Witch Hat Atelier Volume 2. Something that you should also probably give a try to, because this is really good. It's a manga by Komamo Shirahama, and I covered Volume 1 not long ago. It's about a young girl called Coco who accidentally stumbles upon the magic of witchcraft when she is given an old spellbook by a mysterious woman wearing a pointed hat and a mask. She doesn't really understand anything about magic. She's just dazzled by it. And she loves the possibilities of magic. And now she's basically had an accident involving magic. Her mum has been turned to stone. and she has to try and learn magic. But she's been taken in by a witch who is trying to teach her the ways of witchcraft, but trying to teach her this modern version of witchcraft, which is very utilitarian and very much for the people, rather than the old school witchcraft, which basically involves loads of spells that are now considered forbidden. The thing is, there's deeper things at work here, and the old school witches who are still around, they regard Coco as somebody who can change the balance of things, but Coco doesn't even know what she's capable of. She doesn't know anything about magic still. She's still learning. And when we left this at the end of the first volume, Coco and her newfound fellow apprentices had been trapped in what's basically a pocket dimension with a dragon. And so they have to try and work out where the exit is and also avoid getting killed by the dragon, which they do successfully eventually after many trials and tribulations. And then it goes into more of the utilitarian side of magic in this world and the utilitarian side of witchcraft in particular, and how these modern witches go around helping people and assisting people. There's a landslide because of the weather, and so her teacher is going out to help out along with his watcher fellow. And so two of the apprentices, Agot and Coco, go with him to try and assist. But little does anyone know that the old school witches, they are also involved in this, and they've done something which leads to quite a cliffhanger, because at the very end you have this force who basically are they're like the special forces, but also the police for modern witchcraft, and they absolutely do not tolerate any use of forbidden spells, any old school witchcraft whatsoever, and they will forcefully wipe the memory of anyone involved in it, regardless of who they are. And so now Coco is tied up and captured by them and about to lose her memory. So, cliffhangers. Now, Witch Hunter, I tell you, is remarkably well drawn. It's very, very accessible, but the artwork is gorgeous. It's really, really good. You've read Berserk, right, Andrew?
I have. I've read some of Berserk. I really need to go back to it at some point.
Okay. You know how detailed the characters are in Berserk, yeah?
Oh, yeah. That is incredible art.
Yeah. Think Berserk levels of detail.
Very nice.
Yeah. The artwork is phenomenal in this throughout. Now, it doesn't really focus too much on the background.
Does she also have to fight, like, weird evil gods in a land made entirely out of screaming faces?
Possibly. I don't know yet. I've only read the second volume. But that may happen. We are dealing with witchcraft, and the old school witches, they wear pointy hats and never reveal their faces. They always wear masks or something like that. Whereas the new witches, they all wear just pointed hats and that's it. So, yeah, there are all sorts of ways this could go. I am very curious as to how it's going to progress. This is shaping up to be a remarkable series. And as I said when they covered the first one, this basically swept across Japan. Now, this is more for the manga and anime watchers among the audience.
I've watched a manga.
Yes.
Pretty dull. It didn't do anything. It just sat there.
Yes, I know. I've also grown plants out of manga, but, you know, we won't go there. That was a different experiment altogether.
Plants. Uh-huh.
This has elements of Negima in there without the fan service, thankfully. This has elements of Little Witch Academia and Twin Witches in there. Again, without the kind of antsiness or without too much of the overly cute aspect of Little Witch Academia, it kind of hits the perfect balance between magic and fantasy and the kind of personal realism, if that makes sense. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to the next volume.
I'll have to borrow this stuff you at some point, or just flick through and go, ooh, look at the pretty pictures.
Yep. It's very good. And also, the magic makes sense. You know, the way they explain the actual technical side of the magic works. It makes total sense in terms of how the world works, which is something.
Oh, good.
That's
I think like a nice kind of functional magic system.
Yeah, it's kind of a rarity.
It's because it can be hard to write magic when it's just, yeah, you just do whatever and stuff happens.
Or you have an X-Man called Magic who's actually a woman.
What? Do you do this on purpose just to confuse me? Because you know I don't do X-Men.
Nobody does X-Men.
Also, Magic doesn't actually do magic.
Yeah, I know.
She just stabs things with a big sword.
I know. Can you imagine if she just turns up, you know, and she goes, now you see the head? Now you... Oh, God. Does that mean she was the one who taught the Joker that pencil trick?
I would not put it past her. That is a very Ilyana Rasputin thing to do.
Exactly.
She's not the demonic messiah. She's just a very naughty girl. Anyway, Mick, back to you.
Back to me. Right. I've got the Scooby-Doo of superheroes now.
Really? Really, Williams?
Oh, that's right.
As Ironheart. And this is collecting Ironheart 1-6 by Eve Ewing, with art by Luciano Vecchio and Kevin LeBranda. And seriously, Marvel, employ some letterers. Whoever VCR, they're making a fortune out of you.
I was going to say...
And yet you're wanting to put them out of business.
Well, I just feel that, you know... I remember a time when all the letterers came from the comic company that you were reading. They weren't subcontracted in.
It seems like a weird line in the sand to be drawing, Mick, is all I'm saying.
I'm not drawing the line. I'm not the one who's only subcontracting out the lettering.
I was going to say, if Mick was drawing the lines, the artwork in comics would be very different.
It would. You think Rob Liefeld had difficulty with form. But anyway, the lettering in this case has been subcontracted out to VC's Clayton Cowles.
Again.
So, this is... I went into this kind of open-minded. I was aware of Riri Williams, and I know there's been a lot of talk that maybe if they revisit the Iron insert name here franchise in the future in the movies, that it might be an Ironheart or a Riri Williams driven Iron Man.
When you said Iron insert name here, I just suddenly thought, are they going to do like different body parts following Iron, like Iron arm, Iron neck, Iron finger,
Iron lung,
Iron lung, Iron anus?
Hey, would it be a fun joke if they did one called Iron Fist? Can you imagine how silly that would be?
Yeah, I was actually thinking of Iron Fist as well. Iron Big Toe.
Actually, no, because that's Iron Fist, but with a space, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you could have Iron Fist versus Iron Fist as a mashup.
Hmm.
World's greatest martial artist versus man with a metal hand.
Hold on, that's the Winter Soldier.
That's even better. What if the Winter Soldier is just Bob Mortimer from Atletico Mint with his grass hand?
We should not be allowed near comics.
On microphones, more to the point.
So Riri Williams, in Those With Courage, is pottering around in a lab at MIT, and the plot, it has to be said, is a bit of a mess. Essentially, there's a couple of plots going on. There's a plot featuring, and Andrew, I'm coming to you on this for your encyclopedic knowledge, Midnight's Fire.
Ooh, that's an obscure reference. But they are like a group of villains from the New Warriors, I believe.
Oh, this is just one. One guy called Midnight's Fire.
Oh, no, wait, yeah, no. Midnight's Fire is the guy. And then he got a group that's called like Midnight Circle.
Ah, well, he's obviously ditched the Midnight Circle in this because, and this is relevant to our Comic-Con news burst that we did, he's actually working for the Ten Rings.
Well, look at that unsurprising bit of movie synergy.
Well, I say, I don't know. It's almost like he's trying to sort of like do an audition piece for them. There's a guest appearance by someone, and again, I'm looking to you, Andrew, for clues, because it appears to be someone called Clash.
Clash, yeah, that one I'm more familiar with. He is a Spider-Man villain. He's a guy who went to school with Peter Parker, invented technology that makes him, that's going to like turn sound into like shockwaves and uses that to do crimes.
Yeah, so he turns up and he appears to be trying to work for the Ten Rings, and that he's trying to prove himself worthy of the Ten Rings' attention. Anyway, you know, Riri sort of sorts him out and defeats him. And then later on, a lot of kids go missing. Then they turn up on the street doing robbings.
Doing robbings or doing robins?
Robbings, as in stealing things from people, like lads do. And one of the kids that's gone missing is an old school friend of Riri's who protected her back in the day. And this is a comic book that has more flashbacks than an average episode of Arrow.
Is impressive.
Anyway.
The Queen must be an absolute pain at parties. can you pass me the potato? Potatoes. That reminds me of one time on the island.
He basically is the old fellow with all the war stories, isn't he?
During the war. So, anyway, as she's investigating the disappearance of all these kids, that's when Midnight's Fire turns up. And he seems to be trying to recruit her. And then she appears to have a flashback of her not turning to dust, but turning to dust at the hands of Thanos. And it's all about facing her fears and carrying on being a hero through fears. And again, a bit like the Winter Soldier piece, it's a theme that we've seen done 100 times in comic books. There's the whole connecting with friends, reconnecting with old friends, blah, 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 blah. And then the explanation behind Midnight Fire working for the Ten Rings makes them seem like a really pointless organization. Apparently they want power so that they can amass a load of weapons so that they can get more power that they won't actually do anything with. They'll just have it like on the shelf.
Yeah, that's what I never understood, right, about supervillains in general. They never really explain what they're going to do after they take over the world or, you know, they're in charge of everything.
Well, I think the idea is just so that you can walk around going, hey, 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 see that lamppost? See that lamppost? It's mine. See that church?
I've just figured it.
See that pavement? It's mine.
I've just figured out who the leaders of the Ten Rings are. It's 80s techno group, Snap.
No, it's because they've got the power.
That's right.
Boy, that's going to... If people thought they hated the Mandarin twist in Iron Man 3... Wait till we find out in Shang-Chi that the real Mandarin is just 80s band Snap, who turned to villainy after being inspired by Thanos.
And they're aided by their henchman Rhythm, who it turns out is a dancer. Anyway.
Actually, it works because he could be like tied to the Soul Gem.
Well,
because he's its companion.
Wasn't it Rhythm is a dancer? It's a source of anger. You can feel it in the air.
Yeah.
So that means...
No, it's a soul's companion.
I don't know. I can't remember.
Surely. Can't be. It's a source of anger.
I can't remember. It's a soul's companion makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
All that angry dancing I did.
Anyway, it then. So, yeah, this mighty powerful. Ten Rings backed Midnight Fire guy just sort of disappears into the background somewhere, having not been fully defeated but not actually winning or anything. Turns out there's a bent local official that's been
been working alongside the Ten Rings. And Riri saves the day and rescues the kids and everything's hunky-dory. And then for no apparent reason, issue 6, she's looking for Miles Morales, who's been missing for a few days and basically does Groundhog Day with Miles Morales. There's a bit of a guest appearance by Kamala Khan, who sends Riri on the mission. And it's basically bonding with her friend, who she didn't realise was her friend because she didn't think she actually liked him. And it's, yeah, a bit twee. And they meet up with, again, Andrew, the tank.
I don't think I know the tank.
The tank appears looking like some kind of feeble sort of alien stroke cyborg thing who's doing an experiment on Miles Morales observing him in a certain set of environments. And when he finds out that his experiment has been ruined, he sort of hulks out and becomes a really angry guy who's been doing experiments and about 140 times bigger than he was originally. But hey, Miles Morales, Spider-Man, and Riri sort it out and go home, and they're best buddies. Well, they tolerate each other.
They're work friends.
Yes.
Yeah, they have each other's numbers, but they don't text, you know, that kind of thing.
Miles has a thing going on with Gwen Stacy anyway, so...
That doesn't stop him being friends with Riri.
Although he did fancy Kamala for a bit.
Again, doesn't stop him being friends with Riri. Anyway, it's a so-so. The art is reasonably good. I would say that the artwork in the Spider-Man issue is better than most of the rest of it. It's just a shame when, you know, it's kind of taken the edge off the news that there's a Shang-Chi movie coming out, because now I know that the Ten Rings are just like wanting to collect power so they can put it on the mantelpiece next to their football trophies.
Yeah, hopefully the movie Ten Rings will not be that.
Yes.
It's taken the shine off it.
Yeah.
Ironheart, those with courage.
Yeah, so I guess it's me. Yeah, so I have been reading a volume 4 of Stephen McCrane's Space Boy. So this is, to remind people, the story of a girl named Amy who grew up on a deep space mining colony, but then had to go to Earth. But to do so, it meant she had to go into stasis for 30 years and is now, you know, woken up and is trying to adjust to a world she doesn't quite understand or is in any way familiar with. And on top of that, she's also investigating a mysterious boy in her school called Oliver, who there's just something not quite right about him.
Does he glitter in the sunlight?
Oh, no. Oh, that would be a turn. That being said, it wouldn't even be that unexpected, because in this volume, things do get a bit crazy. Because I think it's one of those books where it's quite easy to get lost in the kind of high school romance / drama stuff that you forget there's also like a big weird sci-fi plot going on in the background. So basically, Amy and Oliver, they get quite close. There's a fun little bonding bit where, like, she tries to make s'mores in his house, you know, roasting marshmallows, only to accidentally, like, have it catch fire, and so she flings it on his settee, and then he just kind of goes, well, I'll need to clean this, grabs the cushion, spins it around. Which, again, another handy 4-panel tip. How to clean things. If people can't see the dirt, it's not really dirty.
Someone walks into Andrew's room. Was your carpet always this lumpy, Andrew? Yes.
Exactly. They'll never know the truth. Just whatever you do, don't open the door. Or what you mean, the cupboard door, which is holding back the tidal wave of junk.
Is this the jug that you couldn't fit under the carpet?
Maybe. Let me zoom enough to do some cleaning.
Yes.
So, anyway, things seem to be going nice. Amy and Oliver, they're getting, you know, quite close. Maybe there's a little something-something going on. Only for Oliver to suddenly be rung by, like, the high commander of Earth's military force to say, no, you have to break away from this girl. You're compromising the mission. And when he refuses, she points him towards a weird cyborg-faced bowler hat assassin man pointing his laser rifle at, like, Amy's skull. So, yeah, things take a turn.
That's a hell of a turn.
Because I thought, you know, because there has been a lot of hints that Oliver might not be entirely human. So I was thinking there's maybe some kind of, oh, he's like a robot or something, and it's going to be a nice, just, you know, romantic comedy about teaching the robot how to do emotions right. But nope, now it's all robot assassins and secret government missions. Oh, and also prom.
Prom as in Carrie, prom.
I mean, at this point, who knows? I mean, this is a book in which the simultaneous plot lines about, like, a robot assassin stalking Amy and also them trying to build a special pumpkin float for parade day.
Okay.
It is still rather sweet and lovely, though.
Okay. So to recommend still from you, then?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely still a recommend. It's kind of... It's hard to say a lot about, because I feel like it's just... It's a book that's been pretty much maintaining the same level of quality.
Yeah. That's actually the perfect segue there, Andrew. I am going to quickly sneak this in, very sneakily, because it's Predator Hunters 2. I did Predator Hunters a while back, and we learned that there are a group of humans who are going around hunting predators who are hunting people on Earth. So the hunters are being hunted by more hunters who were hunted themselves.
But who hunts the hunters who hunt the hunted?
I don't know. It all gets very confusing. But anyway, the last place you would expect to find a predator is also the first place you'd expect to find a predator. And in this case, that would be Afghanistan, where the predator has gone. The Taliban have kidnapped a CIA agent and they're about to do their video beheading thing, but then they all get beheaded by the Predator while they're basically shouting suitably Islamic slogans and things like that. And so this begins in a very slightly disturbing way, but it avoids doing the whole kind of God bless the US type thing, which I think is actually a good move. They avoid any reference to the USA or anything like that. They make it very clear, this is an alien doing this. This has nothing to do with international politics or religion or anything like that. And so this group who are hunting the predators are heading to Afghanistan, but the US government have also sent their own mercenaries in to hunt the predator and steal its technology, whereas this group is just going in there because it's a predator we're going to kill. And it's nice because this is a direct continuation from the first Hunters story. And so you have this linearity, you have this continuity to it, which you see. But also, you have a certain degree of sacrifice. One of the characters who you met in the first volume, he basically dies to take out the Predator in this one, while making a friend in Afghanistan at the same time. And so you have this idea come the end of it that this is all leading up to a big kind of face-off between humans and predators at the end, because now they're actually going more tit-for-tat. Predators come to Earth to hunt humans, but then humans are coming to hunt the predators. So this can only end really one way. And I'm hoping that they do continue down that route. I'm hoping that it does eventually lead to us versus them in a big punch-up. Anyway,
then they sneak aboard the Predator ship, find like a special chamber. They open it up, and inside is Hunter S. Thompson.
Yes.
The ultimate Predator hunter.
Yes. But anyway, this is written by Chris Warner, with art by Augustin Padilla, colours by Niraj Menon, letters by Michael Heisler. It's worth a read if you are looking for something new for Predator, and if you really didn't like the movies, which I think we're kind of all in agreement with, that we didn't like the Predators movie.
I didn't mind the first one.
Yeah, the first one with Arnie was good. The second one with...
I think the problem with Predator, and I've said this before when I've done the omnibus editions, is it's kind of a one-trick pony story.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I like where this Hunter's storyline is going. It's basically the predators are hunting humans, and then you've got this group of survivors of predators who are going around hunting the predators themselves. It'll eventually come to a point where either the predators basically lay off planet Earth for good, or the predators will come to Earth in force, and then it'll be the start of a big war between humans and predators. Because I don't really think there's any room for dialogue between the two races.
No?
But you think they
what
could
if we draw up a deal to break away from the predators and we just sit down, have some hardcore negotiations with them?
Do we have to send a shaved ape to be our negotiator?
I don't think he has to shave.
But yeah, that was predators. Never thought of that end in the Brexit joke.
Yeah, that's it. That's the show.
Yes. If you want to listen to any of our other episodes or any of the other shows on the Geek Show Podcast Network, then you can find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, where you'll also find our Patreon and our shop. So if you can show your support, we'd be greatly appreciative of that. You'll also find all the other shows that we do, as well as various other reviews, video game reviews and various other shows. We'll also have our List of Mania things and Graham's Shortcuts and loads of other stuff. So check it out. If you're listening through any kind of podcast service like Audioboom or Apple Podcasts or Deezer, Spotify, Acast, whatever, leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us with exposure. It does help us improve ourselves as well. That's it from us. Until next week, what are we doing next week? Do we know? Are we doing Supermartin's Weird Powers?
Oh goodness, I completely forgot about that. We can do, we might do.
Well,
I think we've got a few places we can go for our next few episodes.
Yes, we do.
It's a very exciting time.
Yes, it is. What a time to be alive. But anyway, until next time,
Hold on. You've picked the exciting times for when I'm on hiatus for a month.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mick's going to be away for the next month or so.
Exciting times. What a time to be alive.
Unless you're Mick, where you'll just be stuck inside studying all month.
So,
I hate you.
Until next time, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Ad.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.